This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
It's Wednesday, November 15th, 2023, from Peachfish Productions in Israel. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Daphna Sella is guiding a crowded conference room through a presentation, positioning a mouse over a picture on a screen.
On October 7th, I was on my way back home from my honeymoon. And as we landed in Turkey, we had a connected flight. We got dozens of messages about what started to happen in the kibbutz near the border.
5 weeks ago in this Tel Aviv office building, someone sitting in her chair, positioning that mouse, directing the attention of the people in this room, might have been highlighting sales figures or pointing to a new product line. Today, and for the last few weeks, the workings of this building have been dedicated to the hostage advocacy group Bring Them Home. It's more than a group. It's really a national movement. It's really the nation. Daphna is talking about her cousin, Lilach Kipnis.
And our entire family is like that. Strong people who care about human rights.
She was among the approximately three dozen kidnapped from Kibbutz Be'eri, close to Gaza. Daphna's cousin, Orshel, next to her, speaks about another relative.
Our cousin, Shoshan. She's now held hostage. She founded an NGO called Fair Planet. What they do is teach farmers in Africa how to grow edible plants that are adequate to the climate there.
Or a blonde music producer. And Daphna, whose brown hair cascades alongside her downcast face, are committing to a strategy that we've seen before. Saw it in Silence of the Lambs, or any time there's an Amber Alert and a grieving mother addresses a camera. You humanize the hostages. You make them real. You make the hostage takers care. You make the world pay attention. Daphna moves on to her cousin, Yehel Gani Shoham.
She is only 3 years old.
Yehel smiles out from under an explosion of curls that frame her face like sunshine.
I don't think you need to say much when you see this picture, but I keep thinking, is she getting the food she needs in order to develop? Is she getting the hug she needs? Is she with her mother?
It is hard to know which of the messages work, if any do. Two of the Sella's cousins have been released. They're the Americans Judith Renan and her 17-year-old daughter, Natalie. But they're Americans. That must have played a role. Soon, the meeting has an unexpected visitor.
Children with trauma who live in the kibbutzes or near the border and suffer from...
It's Yossi Cohen, the previous head of the Mossad, Israel's CIA. Cohen is now speaking from the vantage point of a negotiator. He acknowledges that the Qataris are less than perfect intermediaries, but they are what Israel has to work with.
Okay, to go see the Emir, Sheikh Hamad, I mean, people that I know for many years, I've been there. Speaking to them privately about our needs is unique to me, right? When you know that there is only one negotiator and it is now them. Because they could have told you or me, you know what? Okay, we're not doing it anymore. Or we don't have any interest in doing it from now on.
Cohen says the elements that might convince Hamas, as mediated through Qatar, to release hostages are one, embarrassment, two, hopelessness on the battlefront. And then Orr breaks in. "I'm not a strategic guy," he says, but continues.
"But if I may suggest a third option, which is human beings are human beings, and people from Hamas has families, and although we all want to see the enemy as someone who is not human at all, but every human being has some humanity in them."
"Yes, yes, of course," says Cohen, as a cell phone rings and an aide rushes to take the call. "We will use all levers. We will use the fact that so many hostages have other passports, and those countries want them back." As the aide tugs on his sleeve metaphorically with pleading eyes. "But yes," says Cohen, "all good points." Orsella's eyes are darting back and forth in his head as he tries to come up with what he's saying next. You could tell he cannot believe he is in this situation on so many levels. He's improvising, he's hoping his points get through, he's hoping his points are good ones. He wants to save his family's lives via the message that many of them spent their lives in pursuit of. These are people who believe in peace. They believe in good works for others and human connection and healing the world.
And again, I'm not a political guy, but to differentiate the Israelis from different nationalities, it feels like something that may hurt the international efforts, because when you speak about human beings, regardless of their nationality, I feel that it can resonate also with the Arab world, because any human being is a human being.
"Yes," says Cohen. "We will try," he tells Orr and Daphne Sella. Then he leaves to liaise or negotiate with emirs, emphasizing he'll use whatever message works. The Sellas give way to Eli David, brother of hostage Ivatar David. He's one of the hostages that Hamas showed footage of bound and face down on the floor. Today, there is word, stronger than rumor, less than fact, of an impending deal. Perhaps the women and children will be released. That would not include Avatar and 150 or so other men, many old, mostly civilians. Yossi Cohen continues his work, talking with the relevant go-betweens. The Sellas continue on, hoping, waiting for better news. And an office building in Tel Aviv hums with so much more work to be done. On the show today, we feature an interview with Patrick Brown. He recently wrote a piece in which he disclosed that, while he did not lie, he did not tell the whole truth about his investigation into climate science. The politics of the situation came into play. Patrick Brown, up next.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
This episode is brought to you by The Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about The Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. So as you know, if you listen to this show, I'm a bit of a pain in the ass when it comes to attributing natural phenomenon on one distinct factor, like, say, climate change. When the Canadian fires were raging, I did a whole, what do we call it, a spiel. How much can we blame global warming or climate change on the Canadian fires? I quoted from Nature, the journal Nature, not just the natural state of the world. They quoted Piyush Jain, a research scientist at the Canadian Forest Service, saying it's unlikely to be related to an El Nino climate pattern. Still, the journal said extraordinary weather is not unexpected as the planet warms. Quote, climate change is definitely a factor that is causing these extreme conditions to occur more frequently. So I marveled at the apparent contradiction there. You always see this in coverage of natural disasters. And it's not wrong. Climate change certainly contributes. And in some cases greatly contributes. But in areas like the frequency of hurricanes, it seems not to be a huge contributing factor. Look at the number of hurricanes, they haven't really gone up. In things like the amount of rain delivered by hurricanes, that seems very much to be affected by climate change. So I put this all out there because the other day I was reading an essay in the Free Press by Patrick T. Brown, and the headline, who is a researcher and an expert in the area, the headline is, I left out the full truth to get my climate change paper published. I just got published in Nature, that's the journal Nature, not just things and trees in the world, because I stuck to a narrative I knew the editors would like. That's not the way science should work. I agree. Patrick Brown, welcome to The Gist.
Thanks for having me.
How much chicanery was involved in that paper, Patrick?
Well, not actually a lot of chicanery. It's more, so let me zoom out and kind of tell you the theme of what the piece was about. So I do think there's this dominant or preferred narrative when it comes to the, you know, climate change impacts on society. And this definitely runs through the highest profile research papers and these high impact journals. And it's also, you know, because of that, it's really kind of penetrated the zeitgeist of at least the left of center public that's paying attention to that type of media. And that narrative is, you know, it's a narrative that centers climate change impacts. Even though there's, you know, many causal factors in a lot of these situations that we're looking at, it centers climate change impacts as kind of a motivation to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And it's kind of this bleeds it leads type of headline that is not just from the media, but coming from research papers themselves. So I discussed in that essay how I think that type of framing leaves out the full story or the full truth. So I personally recognize as a researcher that kind of playing into that type of narrative would be a high return investment for me to get a high profile research paper. So we need to publish as researchers. And so we're always looking to publish in the most prestigious journals and to get the most citations and to get essentially attention for your work. You want your colleagues to notice you and to think of you highly. And so I was just pointing out that the way the research paper is framed, everything is fine about the research paper itself. It's, you know, all of the assumptions are laid out, but it just focuses very narrowly on the climate impact of wildfires, even though we know many other things are going on. And so it just quantifies that aspect of it. And I think that actually, in retrospect, was not the most useful use of my time as a researcher, because it's, you know, one of the main reasons is that it doesn't then address practical on the ground solutions to wildfire issues.
So let's get to that in a second. But I think my listeners need to know, and this is on me that I didn't state it up front. The paper was, and this conveys what the point was, the title, Climate Warming Increases Extreme Daily Wildfire Growth Risk in California. In a perfect world, well, so imperfect that there'd be all these wildfires, but in the perfect academic world, what would your paper have emphasized? Or what's an alternative title that would have correctly summarized what your ideal paper would have said?
So I don't think the an ideal paper would not have a title that's a headline title like that. It would be, you know, quantification of all important causal factors on wildfire behavior in California in the past and projecting them into the future.
Gotcha. So if you were trying to explain this to your aunt who has a college degree, but not a PhD, and you just published the ideal paper phrased in the way and with the research that you really would have wished Nature would have published, how do you explain to the layman what that paper says?
Well, I think that that's part of the problem, actually, is that the ideal paper is much more complicated because the real world is much more complicated. And so it would be, you know, it would have all these dependencies in it. It would say, well, we looked at all of the things that we think are important for wildfire behavior, including changes in ignition patterns and changes in fuel and vegetation over time and changes in climate. And the results are, they're kind of muddled. It depends on where and when and over what time frames and all that. And that's not conducive for a high profile, high impact paper, even though that's the complicated reality that we live in. And so it's hard to explain that to your aunt who's not in the field. But that's actually, I think, the most kind of useful knowledge for society is to say, well, in the future, you know, given climate change, and if we do this, we can mitigate climate change or we can offset climate change with, you know, mechanical thinning and prescribed burning in this area. But it's contingent on these other factors. It's not a clean story. It's not nearly as clean. And so it's not going to get grabbed by the media, and it's not going to be as likely to be in a high profile journal. But so I think that's kind of the problem that I'm highlighting. Actually.
Might it say something like, I mean, is it true that climate change contributes to wildfires, but it may be the second or third most important contributor?
Right. That certainly is when you're talking about hazardous fuel, when you're talking about the buildup of fuels, that is absolutely a plausible scenario.
But your paper didn't actually find or look at what the other causes might be.
Right. So what I'm saying is that even though that would have been more valuable research, it's more practical, more useful. I recognize that that was not nearly as high a return on investment as a researcher. And so I'm trying to put blame on myself for doing that, but then also trying to close the gap between what would be best for a researcher's career and what's best for society.
Is there one sentence you would change if you could resubmit your paper, knowing it would be published, but encapsulating the more perfect world that we posit?
Well, no, because really what I'm challenging is the research question itself, not the paper. So the paper is fine and all of the assumptions are laid out perfectly in the paper. It doesn't claim that we're looking at these other factors. It says very plainly that we're not. We're only looking at the climate change factor. So the paper is fine. It's the research question itself.
Yeah. So what's another factor? Vegetation and ignition. What does ignition mean in this context?
Human ignition patterns. So humans ignite 80 to 90% of wildfires in California. And so depending on where those ignitions happen, that could affect wildfire danger or in the context of this paper, the risk of extreme daily wildfire growth. And so incorporating that, which is a really important factor, and incorporating the buildup of vegetation. So that situation is that we decided as a society early in the 20th century, that we're going to put out all wildfires as soon as they're ignited. And so we used to have a situation with with higher frequency, low intensity fires. So every decade or so, fires would come through and clear out the vegetation between the more mature trees. And since that policy was enacted, we now have a century's worth of vegetation buildup. So then when there is a fire, it's much more intense, much harder to fight. And so that is a huge factor affecting these wildfires.
Is there a way, has anyone quantified that? To both of those, we looked at the number of times people were lighting things on fire, or I don't know, some other factor, the severity, the intensity of these human ignitions, or studying the amount of vegetation. Is that possible? Has that study been done?
Yeah, well, we're doing it now with the same, under the same framework, but there's been many, many studies in more narrow senses, looking at smaller areas or individual fires, looking at the effect of the fuel change. And those studies, along with our current work that we're doing, really highlights that it's a huge factor. But again, my point is—
So you're saying if your study that you spent all your time with wasn't about the extreme daily wildfire growth risk in California from climate warming, if you had and your team focused the attention on the extreme daily wildfire growth risk because of vegetation, nature wouldn't be interested, you're saying?
Well, I think there's kind of two versions. There's the version that's much more all-encompassing in terms of factors. And that's going to be a much more boring paper that would not be high impact.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a version that ignores climate change and only looks at one of these other causal factors. And I think that it would just not get through reviewers. They would say, why would you ever not look at climate change as well?
Well, that would be flawed, right? That would be flawed not to look at climate change.
Yeah, that would be flawed, but then the same argument could be made about my paper.
Right. So that's it. That's the crux of your argument. You could do a paper that only looks at climate change and it gets published. You can't look at a paper that doesn't look at climate change and hope for it to get published.
Yeah, and it's really, really what I'm worried about is the larger scale of so many papers doing this on different aspects of society, whether it be crop yields or deaths from non-optimal temperatures or GDP or anything, that there's such a emphasis on seeking out and highlighting a negative climate change impact kind of within the noise of everything else that's going on. So even though there's positive trends in all these climate sensitive aspects of our society, the papers go in and they look and they find, you know, within that data, they find the negative impact from climate change and then frame the paper around that. And then that is what's getting kind of pumped out to the public all the time. And I think it gives a very skewed view of how large these impacts are relative to everything else that's going on.
We'll be right back with Patrick Brown after the break. Welcome back to The Gist. We continue our conversation with climate scientist Patrick Brown. So speaking of wildfires, did you burn your career by writing this free press article?
That's to be determined. We will see.
Well, tell me, I mean, you're not on a tenure track and you decided not to be for a while. You're a co-director of the Breakthrough Institute. So that means, well, you tell me, you said, I know I'm not going to be a professor.
Yeah. Yeah. I would never have done this from within the academy if I was still a professor. And you see, I mean, so I was definitely expunged from that community, and there's a lot of high-profile negative reaction publicly. By the way, my inbox is flooded with really positive reaction from other PhD researchers, so I got a lot of validation from
back channel, right? They say I can't possibly put this on the record anywhere or publicly stick up for you,
right?
But did you decide to leave academia before the free press piece?
Yes, I mean, but this was part like kind of feeling pressure to do research that I didn't think was necessarily the most useful was one of the reasons that I was uncomfortable in academia, frankly. But I just want to say that the social, all the social negativity that I got from this from within the community is part of the thing that I'm talking about, that you once kind of a mainstream thinking kind of takes hold, and you're trying to navigate the career, you know, stepping stones within your field, you don't want to ruffle a bunch of feathers. You don't want to make people mad at you or have, you know, weird thoughts about you, essentially. And that social dynamic within the field affects outcomes of the research. And I just think that people should be aware of that dynamic.
How big a threat to humanity is the ongoing effects of climate change?
That's such a big question. I think that, I guess what I'm highlighting is that the dynamic that I see makes it so that most people that would be my contemporaries, kind of educated, left of center people, have a way more pessimistic view about climate change than I do looking at the data. I think that that's just informed, again, by looking at all of our climate sensitive aspects of society and how they've all gone in a positive direction over the past 50 years, despite that we've had 1 degree Celsius warming and we're expecting another 1 to 1.25 degree Celsius warming over the next 50 years. And I see no reason why these countervailing forces that are offsetting the influence of climate change would suddenly stop. And so I'm very optimistic for humanity going forward. We do need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, or we do need to reduce CO2 emissions to zero in order to stabilize the climate. And so that is something that we need to be pushing in that direction for. But that's, you know, my view is more that, yeah, we're not going to meet the Paris goals of 1.5 or 2 degrees Celsius, but we're also not going to be on these crazy high emission scenarios that are used by a lot of these papers to get extremely large numbers. So we're going to be at 2.5 degrees Celsius, 3 degrees Celsius warming by the end of the century. And given that, I think we should be studying, you know, much more practical on the ground solutions to impacts that come up. And also making sure that we're not standing in the way of economic development, because that is the main thing that we see historically and across space today that protects people from the climate.
If you were a scientific advisor to the president, would you tell him or her to withdraw or not withdraw from the Paris Climate Accords when Donald Trump made that decision?
No, I would not tell them to withdraw. The Paris Agreement does not really have teeth necessarily. So there's no downside to being in it, practically speaking. There's a lot of downside to withdrawing, because it shows the rest of the world that you're not willing to cooperate on it. So I would not withdraw.
What kind of car do you drive?
Right now we have one car in my family we've been sharing, and it's a Prius.
Ah, that's the best one, right?
Yeah.
That's the perfect one to burnish your credentials, is it not? Even a Tesla is not as status-inducing as a Prius.
Right. And my wife is in sustainability. I am embedded in this world. I'm not, I guess it's too bad that it matters to people, but I'm not a Republican. I just see in the data something very different than what's getting communicated, and that's one of my main concerns.
What is a commonly repeated trope, talking point related to climate change that you see mainstream media, good newspapers say without really stopping, that you'd like to correct?
I guess in general, just the notion that whatever bad weather is going on that day is due to climate change. And a lot of times there is some aspect, some change in the intensity, but it's usually just much smaller than the way that it's painted.
It used to be de facto, pro forma, that they would say, whereas one weather event cannot be contributed to the global effects. They would at least say that and then say, but, you know, the amount of rain of hurricanes is getting increased. Now but I have noticed that pro forma disclaimer has pretty much disappeared.
Yeah, I think because now there's, you know, climate desks at all these newspapers, and climate is not actually something that's very easy to cover in the news. because it would be like, okay, you're going to wait 20 years and then talk about a trend in something. Where,
yeah, it's so, like having a history desk.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you have to cover all weather in the lens of climate. And a lot of times it's just not really the right lens. I can give you a more specific example for extreme cold. So this is something that is really kind of jarring to me, that all of the consensus science from the IPCC and every other synthesis organization says and shows that as it gets warmer, as we put more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, extreme cold should get warmer. It should not get more extreme. It should not get colder. But there are some research papers that suggest that it's possible that in certain latitudes that it could get colder in certain circumstances. But yet that kind of gets grabbed onto, that's very, very, you know, non-mainstream science, that gets grabbed onto and is like hoisted up as this portion of the science that I think is getting way more credit than it deserves. Right. Because it just feeds into this narrative that, oh, climate change makes everything worse. It makes all extremes more extreme. So we're going to cover extreme cold also under the lens of climate change, not that this cold event actually would have been colder were it not for increasing greenhouse gas concentrations.
Right. So how it plays out is some ignoramus on a very cold day says, I thought there was climate change. I thought there was global warming. And some smart guy says, don't you understand? We know now that the effects of climate change are such that all extremes are exacerbated. But even though the original ignoramus was in fact an ignoramus, that is not the appropriate retort.
Right. Right. It's more just that you still get cold despite the fact that we have a slowly increasing baseline warming.
Patrick T. Brown is the co-director of the Climate and Energy Team at the Breakthrough Institute. He published in the Free Press, I left out the full truth to get my climate change paper published. Thank you so much, Patrick.
Thanks a lot.
Thank your dog for me, too. That's it for today's show. The Gist is produced by Corey Wara. The senior producer is Joel Patterson. Michelle Pesca is CLO of Peachfish Productions. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Umpru, gpru, dupru, and thanks for listening.